Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a non-profit, non-partisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Patricia Patterson. I chair the council, and on behalf of all of the council, its directors, staff, and everyone, we want to welcome you here tonight. We have a wonderful program tonight, one I've personally been looking forward to a great deal, and we're glad to see each and every one of you. Our program tonight is Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power. Now I have the privilege of introducing our speaker for tonight, Robert Dalek. Dr. Dalek is a prominent American historian. He's currently a professor at Boston University. He has authored several books of great acclaim, which include John F. Kennedy, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and American Foreign Policy from 1932 to 1945. He's written Flawed Giant, which about Lyndon Johnson, which and so many of us were involved with the Johnsons and knew the Johnsons, and I think his book on that has been one that's interested me a great deal. And his latest book is Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power, and it's been on a number of bestseller lists, and Bob was just telling me that he is on the McNeil Lair show as we speak. He was either last night or the night before on Charlie Rose. But we're privileged not to have to turn him off or click him on, that we've got the real thing here tonight. And he's going to speak about Nixon and Kissinger, and I'm reminded of the statement that somebody made that Kissinger was the only Secretary of State under whom two presidents had served. So, Bob, come on up.
You got it exactly right. Thank you for that lovely introduction. When I get a nice introduction like that, I'm always put in mind of one I received a number of years back when I was lecturing the Soviet Union. My host on that occasion, who I like to think had an imperfect command of English, introduced me by saying, "Professor Dalek is the author of several distinguished works. They're the kinds of books that once you put them down, you can't pick them up again." not music to the author's ears. I also like to begin these talks with another anecdote about my son, who's now 37, but when he was about 5 years old, he said to me one day, "Daddy," he said, "you're a doctor, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, yes, but not like your doctor, not like your pediatrician." And he said, "Oh, I know that because you're also an historian." Well, I was delighted that he could make this distinction at so young an age. But then he wanted to know, "Does that mean that you make people in the past feel better?" So let's see what I can do for Nixon tonight. Not sure that I can help. In 1994-95, I taught at Oxford as a what was called visiting Holmesworth professor, and I was asked to go on the BBC to debate a historian, another historian by the name of John Cholmley, who was a fierce anti Churchill, an anti-Roosevelt historian. He was convinced that Roosevelt and Churchill had destroyed the British Empire, and he had nothing at all good to say about them. Now, I having published a book on all of Franklin Roosevelt's foreign policy, and which was pretty much an admiring work, we got into a pretty stiff argument. And at the end of this, the host said, "Nothing I like better than a good punch-up between two academics." And at one point, we began arguing about documents. and who had used more. And he said, "Why, I've read more documents on this subject than you will ever read." And so I said to him, "Well, you remind me of what Harry Truman said about Richard Nixon. He may have read the Constitution, but he sure as hell didn't understand it." That debate reminded me of what the great Dutch historian Peter Hale once said, which is that history is argument without end. It's always in dispute. And one of the reasons it's up for such grabs or in such dispute is because we never have a full record. There's no way to entirely reconstruct the past. It's very much an art, a humanistic enterprise. And every time I write a book, I begin with a number of questions that I'm eager to answer about the administration, about the president, about the people around him. And I find that if I can get at the documentary record, if I can penetrate the veneer of these presidential administrations, I can come, of course, closer to the truth, because all these presidents, I don't care what party they're with, they all want you to think they walk on water, that they're free of any misjudgment or error. But happily, there are a mass of documents they leave behind, and then we're able to provide a much more accurate, fuller, richer account of what went on in that administration. So when I started this book on Nixon and Kissinger, I had some doubts. After all, Richard Nixon had a reputation as quote-unquote tricky dick. You had the Watergate crisis. There was all this talk about a cover-up. And so would I be able to penetrate the veneer of that administration? To my surprise, when I got into the archives where the Nixon materials and Kissinger materials are held, I found that this was the most transparent presidential administration I'd ever read about, I'd ever studied. It was astonishing to me what records they left behind. To begin with, the Nixon tapes, 3,700 hours. Now, nobody in his or her right mind would want to listen to these 3,700 hours. They're very difficult to listen to anyway. But 900 of them are still closed. Not because anybody's trying to hide things, the archivists are eager to open them, but you've got to vet them, review them for national security considerations and privacy concerns before you open them up. But still, there were some 2,700 hours there and 2,800 hours. And we were able to mine these, and they are incredibly revealing, not just about Watergate, but about a host of issues, as I'll show you, between Nixon and Kissinger. Secondly, there were the Henry Kissinger telephone transcripts. Kissinger made transcripts of all his phone calls. He had somebody listening in on a dead key, and they would then make transcripts. And I gave a talk at the independent bookstore in Washington, D.C. on Saturday night called Politics and Prose, and this woman came up to me and she said, "I'm J.P. And I said, "J.P.?" She said, "Well, you've read the Kissinger telephone transcripts." I said, "Oh, my goodness." She was the one who transcribed them, and her initials are on all these transcripts. Now, Kissinger instructed that these materials be locked up in the Library of Congress until 5 years after he died. But the historical division in the State Department, which publishes something called Frew's Foreign Relations in the United States, it's a great diplomatic document series going back to 1869. And they said to him, "We've got to have your records if we're going to continue to produce authoritative volumes." And so they pressured him into opening up the records, which came to hand in May of 2004, just 3 years ago. And I mined those materials, and I was stunned at what was left behind, what was there. And one of the puzzles that I'll always have in having done this work is why Kissinger left these materials behind. the historians, biographers to read. Thirdly, there are 800,000 pages of national security files. Again, you can't read all of these, but there is wonderful material in there, including Al Haig's what's called Chron files, chronological files. And then finally, there's the H.R. Bob Haldeman diaries. Now, these were published several years ago, back in the 90s, but there's a CD-ROM version of them, which is a much more complete version of these diaries. They held back all sorts of detail that they didn't want to reveal to the public in the 90s. So I had all this material, and I was able then to, so to speak, penetrate into this administration in a way that I never thought I'd be able to get at the questions I wanted to answer. The first question I posed to myself was, Nixon and Kissinger had a reputation for having achieved some great things in foreign affairs. Is that accurate? Is it reasonable? And my answer to that is yes. They did achieve some extraordinary things. The opening to China, which was a Nixon's initiative, really his initiative, and Kissinger became his instrument in implementing that. And it was a brilliant move. Nixon said, you cannot isolate 800 million people forever. We've got to have relations with them. Détente with the Soviet Union rested on the understanding that nuclear weapons were not usable weapons. The MAD doctrine, mutually assured destruction, their conviction was they had to arrive at some kind of accommodation with the Soviets. But at the same time, they thoughtfully used the opening to China to balance the Soviet initiative, balance of power. The Soviets against the Chinese against the Soviets. They played that game very, very effectively. Thirdly, I would say, was shuttle diplomacy. Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize for Vietnam, and as you'll see, I don't think he ever deserved it for that. What they did on Vietnam, I think, was a disaster for the country. But on shuttle diplomacy, he opened the way to the Camp David peace accords that Jimmy Carter put into action. Carter never would have achieved these, I don't think, without Kissinger's initial shuttle diplomacy. And, of course, this has barred Israel and Egypt from entering into another war. And so, despite all the troubles and ongoing issues and problems in the Middle East, at least we've averted that bigger war between Israel and Egypt, which, of course, is the biggest, the most formidable of the Arab powers. So the next question I posed to myself was, given these achievements, why is this administration now viewed by so many historians as something of a failure? Why is it seen as something of a disaster? Well, of course, the surface answer is Watergate. Nixon forced to resign, the only president in the country's history to be compelled to resign because of Watergate. But what I want to argue to you this evening is that Watergate was sort of the symptom, and that the cause was an atmosphere of consummate deception, manipulation, lying, double dealing, and it went on within the administration itself and in some of the foreign policy making that they conducted. Let me give you the most striking example that I found in developing this argument. Deception between Nixon and Kissinger. On the surface, people saw them as a collaborative, brilliant collaborative team. But when you penetrate the veneer and you get at the records, what you see is that they were fierce, bitter rivals for power. Now, Nixon came to office determined to run foreign policy. That was his forte. He said, domestic affairs is a matter of building outhouses in Peoria. Foreign policy is what really counts. This is what's truly important to the nation, national security, foreign policy. And he wanted to run it himself. And he appoints a man named William Rogers as Secretary of State. And he does this on purpose because his conviction is that Rogers doesn't know a lot about foreign affairs, and that Nixon will be able to totally dominate him. He appoints Kissinger because Kissinger is a kind of ornament in his eyes. He's a Harvard professor with a series of significant publications and a distinction in discussing nuclear weapons and national security matters. And he's also Rockefeller's advisor. And to take him away from Rockefeller, so to speak, is a feather in Nixon's cap. And here he is, he's an academic, and Nixon's conviction is he'll be able to dominate him. He should have known what some of Kissinger's colleagues at Harvard knew about him. Because the story would make the rounds at Harvard that one summer's day, Kissinger was walking out on the campus, and he spotted a young man who was one of his assistants and a very attractive young woman who was an aspiring English journalist from London. He went up to them, started chatting, and she was extremely cool to him, and it irritated Kissinger. And he said to her, "Why don't you like me?" And she said, "Because you're a fascist." And he said, "A fascist? Why, I was in the invasion of Belgium." And she said, "Really? With which army?" Nixon came to understand very quickly that Kissinger was his match in the reach for power, for authority. Here is one of these taped conversations. Nixon talking about Kissinger. "Henry's personality problem," he said, "is just too goddamn difficult for us to deal with," he tells Haldeman. "God damn it, Bob, he's psychopathic about trying to screw Rogers." Haldeman agreed and warned that if Kissinger wins the battle with Rogers, he may not be livable with afterwards. Nixon thought he would become, quote, "a dictator. Did you know that Henry worries every time I talk on the telephone with anybody? He feels he must be present any time I see anybody important." Nixon complained that Kissinger had all these NSC discussions about, quote, "every goddamn little shit-ass thing that happens. He has too many meetings. They go on and on and on and on about crap." The president talking about his national security advisor. Nixon came to enjoy the joke about Kissinger, who was asked by a journalist one day, "How do you feel about the fact that the Constitution doesn't allow you as a foreign-born person to become president?" And Kissinger replied, "Well," he said, "yes, but the Constitution says nothing about my being emperor." And so Nixon, hearing this, nodded with understanding. He resented Kissinger. He disliked the fact that he was his competitor for power, trying to become, so to speak, quote-unquote, a co-president. And he began to abuse him. Behind his back, he'd call him "my Jew boy." Occasionally, he'd say that to his face. They'd be together, and he'd say ugly things about Jews, and he'd turn to Henry and say, "Isn't that right, Henry? Isn't that right?" And Kissinger would say, "Well, Mr. President, there are Jews, and there are Jews." See? They talk about the Middle East, and Kissinger would present his opinion on Middle Eastern policy. And Nixon would say, "Okay, now can we have an American point of view?" See? The anger that Nixon felt toward Kissinger reached a kind of crescendo during the Yom Kippur War in October 1973. Because by then, Nixon was in the throes of Watergate. His power had eroded. His influence had in many respects been shattered. And Kissinger, in essence, took over the running of foreign policy. When Kissinger learned that the war had erupted, October 6, 73, he does not speak to Nixon for 3 hours. Doesn't call him up. And when he does call him up, Nixon almost plaintively asks him to tell the press that Kissinger has been consulting with him every half an hour, every hour, in order to convince the press that Nixon remains very much in charge. 6 days after the war began, there's a transcript of Brent Scowcroft calling up Kissinger and saying to him, it's 5 to 8 in the evening, "Henry, The British Prime Minister has just called, Edward Heath. He wants to speak to the President in about half an hour. And Kissinger says to Scowcroft, Brent, we can't do it. The President is loaded. But tell him I'll speak to him. And the President can speak to him in the morning. See. 2 weeks into the war, 3 weeks into the war, the Israelis have surrounded the Egyptian Third Army in the Sinai. There's supposed to be a ceasefire agreement. The Soviets are furious because the Israelis apparently are violating it, and the Soviets believe the Israelis are aiming now to cut off medicine and food to them so that they'll force a surrender of this army, and they want to prevent it. And so they come to Kissinger, and they say, we intend to send in a paratroop brigade, and we want you to join us and send in an equal force, and we will police this ceasefire. Well, Kissinger and Al Haig, who at this point is Nixon's chief of staff, agree that they're never going to let the Soviets do this. They're going to bar them from doing this. And so Haig and Kissinger, in a telephone conversation, Haig says to him, you're going to have a meeting of national security officials. Kissinger says, yes. Haig says, where are you going to hold the meeting? Kissinger says, at the State Department. Haig says, no, you must do it at the President's house, at the White House, in order to suggest that if the news gets out about this meeting, the President's in charge. See. And Kissinger says to Haig, 10 to 10 in the evening, where's the President? And Haig says, he's asleep. And Kissinger says, well, should we wake him up? And Haig says, no. A half an hour later, they talk again. They don't trust each other. And Haig says to Kissinger, have you talked to the President? And Kissinger says, no, I don't want him charging around here. Seven unelected officials, they meet, and they raise the defense condition. Twice during the Cold War was this nuclear alert, did the nuclear alert happen? Was a nuclear alert, that defense condition raised? Once during the Cuban Missile Crisis under Kennedy, and the second time when Nixon, when Kissinger and Haig did it. The next day, after the Soviets have backed down, and Kissinger gets word of it, the person he speaks to is not Nixon, but Haig. And Haig says, well, have you talked to the President to tell him? He says, no, I'll be calling him in a few minutes. See. And then they talk about the fact that they don't want the press to believe that they cooked this up. See. Now, I asked the archivists, I looked in the archives, is there a single document demonstrating that Nixon signed off on any of this? There's nothing. They did this without Nixon being present. They appropriated the power. When Kissinger calls Nixon, you have the transcript. He says, Kissinger says to him, well, Mr. President, you won again. And Nixon says, great stuff, Henry. See, what is he going to do at this point? He's furious over the fact that he's been so eclipsed. But he's not going to tell him, well, you made a mistake, I'm firing you. He can't. He's caught by this Watergate crisis, and he's utterly dependent on Kissinger for his support. Kissinger has now become a celebrity over the initiative with China and detente with the Soviet Union. Kissinger then embarks on his shuttle diplomacy, and there's a cable in which he writes to Haig and to Scowcroft, and he says, if this information will disturb the President, don't show it to him. Don't show him the cable. He's running foreign policy. I interviewed Brent Scowcroft. He told me Nixon used to complain to him that Henry was taking away power, running roughshod. The night before Nixon resigned, he calls, he has a conversation with Gerald Ford, and he says to him, Jerry, you have to keep Henry on. He's vital, essential for national security, for foreign policy. But every once in a while, you got to kick him in the nuts. Otherwise, he's going to run away with power. Nixon to Gerald Ford. See. Now, Kissinger understood that there was this kind of tension between them. And to his face, he would tell Nixon, Mr. President, without you, this country would be dead. You're the greatest foreign policy maker. He would stroke him like crazy. And Nixon wanted it, needed it. Behind his back, He'd call him the meatball mind. He'd say to somebody, he'd put his hand over the mouthpiece of the phone and say, "It's our drunken friend calling." See, Marvin Kalb, the diplomatic correspondent for CBS, told me. I would talk to Kissinger. He never said to me off the record, never. But he would confide to me in a way that would make me feel I must not betray this confidence. And he'd say to me, "Marvin, you don't understand. He's a maniac. They're lunatics. See, you don't know what I have to put up with. See, Kissinger, I have British documents," in which he talks to the British ambassador and he says to him, "These guys around Nixon are the biggest bunch of crooks you've ever seen." See, I mean, just denouncing them from one end to the other. Amazing indiscretion on his part, it seems to me. After the presidency was over, Kissinger at one point was up in Canada at a dinner, and he didn't know the microphone was open. And there was a Canadian parliamentarian asked him what he actually really, truly thought of Nixon. And he said some very unkind things. Picked up on the microphone, got out over the airwaves, and Kissinger came back to the States, and he called up Nixon and apologized to him. Nixon wasn't appeased. The next time they met, which was 1977 at Hubert Humphrey's funeral, Nixon said to Kissinger, "Henry," he said, "are you still so mean?" And Kissinger said, "Yeah, but I don't have as many opportunities." It was a relationship based on deception, manipulation, deceit, based on the fact that each of them was so driven to hold power, to dominate, to control. The deception they engaged in with each other extended to public policy as well. Just two examples. First, Vietnam. They knew from the start of that Nixon administration that Vietnam was a lost cause. I quote Nixon to Kissinger, "In Saigon, the tendency is to fight this war to victory, but you and I know it won't happen. It's impossible." They talked of Vietnamization, the idea that as the Vietnamese stand up, we will stand down. Nixon knew it wasn't working and was not likely to ever work. In 1971, they encouraged the South Vietnamese to strike the North Vietnamese in Laos, and the South Vietnamese got their heads handed to them. Nixon, I cannot repeat to you the vulgarity he uses on these tapes, talking about the South Vietnamese. "God damn it," he says, "if only they would capture a hill, capture a few prisoners, see, demonstrate some effectiveness. The South Vietnamese Air Force wouldn't bomb North Vietnamese trucks because, quote unquote, they were moving targets." And Nixon blows his stack. What the hell is wrong with them? It's ridiculous. All the money we've put in, all the blood and treasure we've expended. And he saw them as not being able to fight worth a damn. They knew the war was a lost cause. Kissinger talks to the Soviet ambassador, Dobrynin, and he tells him, in essence, tell, and I quote here, he says to him, "You tell your little yellow friends," this is the way he talks about the North Vietnamese, to Dobrynin, "you tell them that, in essence, if we get out, which we will, to give us roughly 18 months, what he's asking for is a decent interval. After we get out, the assumption is the North Vietnamese will resume their aggression. Let's have a fig leaf about peace. They'll resume their aggression, and after 18 months, we won't go back in." Kissinger tells essentially the same thing to Zhou Enlai when he's on his trip to China to open the door for Nixon to come there. When Nixon finally reaches a peace agreement with the North Vietnamese and badges the South Vietnamese into signing on to it, Nixon calls it peace with honor. There's a very interesting book by a historian by the name of Larry Berman called No Peace, No Honor, which is really what it's about. Kissinger tells him, as Nixon's about to go on national television to announce peace with honor, he tells him, "Do not call it lasting, because in essence," he says, "it's not going to last. Maybe it'll be there for a year or two." Let me read you a conversation Kissinger had with the journalist Stuart Alsop in 1970. Kissinger said the president was engaged in a sleight-of-hand performance comparable to de Gaulle's action in ending the Algerian War. Henry called de Gaulle a great illusionist who had staged the retreat from North Africa in a way that made France look more powerful than it actually was. Alsop said, "I've compared Nixon on Vietnam to the Wizard of Oz. His great clouds of rhetoric designed to conceal the fact that he has ordered or embarked on the greatest retreat in history." Kissinger agreed, saying the trick is to stage a great retreat and emerge at the other end still a great power, reasonably cohesive at home. See, they know, and yet they go on with this war for four more years. Some 23,000 more American troops die. They could have ended that war in 1969, and would the outcome have been any different from what we ended up with in 1975? See, I just think this was such a mistake. Now, I know you have to have some kind of fig leaf, some kind of... my friend Walt Rostow, who I became very friendly with when I worked on my Lyndon Johnson books, Walt would say to me, and to public audiences, and I respected this, he would say to me, "We gave the other Southeast East Asian nations time to develop." Now, whether that was true or not, at least it gave the families of those who lost loved ones in that war a feeling that there was some purpose, some point, in the loss of those lives. And one should honor that, because one should respect it. At any rate, it seems to me they deceived the country. And maybe there was a degree of auto-intoxication as well. They kept thinking that they could use military power in Cambodia, in that Laos contest between the South and the North Vietnamese, in the Christmas bombing of North Vietnam, to force them into something that would resemble a peace with honor. But it didn't work. It never worked. A second point about deception: Chile. They forever argued that they really did not interfere in Chile. I did not add that much in my book to this story. I do have some conversations, but by and large, it is well known. The documentary record is crystal clear. The minute Allende was elected by 34%, they wanted to block his presidency by the approval of his presidency by the Chilean parliament, Congress. The tradition in Chile was to give someone who won a plurality that presidential office, which they did. Nixon and Kissinger tried as hard as they could to block it. When he got into power, they used financial and political influence as much as they could. They supported the Chilean military as best they could. Now, they did not order the coup d'etat. They did not instigate the killing of Allende. There's a debate. Did he commit suicide? Was he assassinated? We don't know for sure. But they did not instigate his killing or that coup exactly when it happened. However, listen to this conversation they have and compare it with the public things they say about Chile. "The Chilean thing is getting consolidated, and of course newspapers are bleeding because a pro-communist government has been overthrown," Kissinger told Nixon. "Isn't that something?" Nixon responded. Kissinger then said, quote, "Instead of celebrating, why, in the Eisenhower period, we would be heroes." Nixon interjected, "Well, we didn't, as you know. Our hand doesn't show on this one, though." Kissinger responded, "We didn't do it. I mean, we helped them, created the conditions as great as possible." "That is right," Nixon said. So that's the truth of what went on with Chile. So to conclude, what does all this add up to? What does it mean? Why be concerned about this business of deception? Because it seems to me, as a presidential historian, when presidents deceive the public, it is tremendously destructive to their administrations, to their ability to govern, to their ability to lead the country. Remember that famous anecdote about Lyndon Johnson? How do you know when LBJ is telling the truth When he pulls his earlobe, rubs his chin, he's telling the truth. When he begins to move his lips, you know he's lying. He didn't think it was funny, but it was so revealing of the way in which he had lost public trust, confidence in him. When Richard Nixon told the country at a press conference, "I am not a crook," his presidency was over. Why, how can a president expect to govern, rule, lead the country when he has to tell them, "I am not a crook"? James Madison said that presidents should tell people, the country, not what it wants to know or hear, but what it needs to know, what it needs to learn, what it needs to understand in order to make this a more perfect union, in order to allow the public to be more realistic about public affairs. And this, it seems to me, was the great error defect of this administration, of having been so deceptive to each other, to the public, and in a sense, it created the conditions in which a Watergate could happen, which allowed Nixon then to tumble, become the only president in the country's history to be forced to resign. One should take no satisfaction from it or pleasure in it. It's a tragedy for the country. And what I find so striking nowadays is that when you ask people in this country, who are the greatest presidents in American history, they will tell you Washington, Lincoln, FDR, John Kennedy, and Ronald Reagan. Now, Kennedy, only 1,000 days. Reagan, we haven't had the documentary record yet to really make a kind of thoughtful assessment of how he performed as president. But I think what the public is saying to people in public life is that they want to feel better about the country's institutions. They want to be optimistic. They want to be hopeful. That's what Kennedy and Reagan gave among the modern presidents. Ask not what your country can do for you. Reagan, it's morning in America. The pride is back. They want hope. And that's why I think this fellow Obama has been surging, because this is the message he's giving. Now, we'll see what happens in the course of this, what's going to be a very interesting campaign. But the fact that he speaks of unity, the fact that he speaks of a better day in America, he's taking his text from Lincoln, from Kennedy, from Reagan, see? And what makes him also a compelling figure, he's not the slave narrative, he's the immigration narrative. And this strikes resonant chords with millions and billions of people. Anyway, I'm not going to predict what happens. As a historian, we love to predict the future, but we have enough trouble figuring out the past. Anyway, thank you for being so attentive. Thank you.
As is customary, now we'll open to questions. I'm going to let Dr. Hodges talk for years. I'm sure he's entirely capable of running his own Q&A. But I'd like to start with a question, Dr. Hodges, and then open for the floor, and that is, where do you see the parallels between Iraq now and Vietnam?
You go right for the jugular, don't you? Well, pardon? The question is, are there parallels that you see between Iraq and this Nixon administration or Vietnam? Well, you can read my thoughts on this yesterday in the Washington Post Outlook, the opinion section of the Washington Post on Sunday. I have an article which is titled, Iraq is not like Vietnam, except when it is. And I think there are striking parallels. And striking parallels with Nixon, see. Vietnamization, we talk about Iraqization. It's so difficult to assume that we've reached a point that we can rely on these trained Iraqi police and military. See, my feeling is the president won't sign off on a timetable or on some kind of structured measures for America to get out of there, because he doesn't really have confidence that these Iraqi troops or police are going to be able to handle the security issues. Just as in Vietnam, where we found ourselves in such a quagmire, it was such a tragedy and anguish for the country. This is what seems to be happening again with Iraq. What's puzzling to me is the fact that Vietnam, we lost 58,700 American lives, not to mention the tens of thousands of, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese who perished. The loss of American lives in Vietnam, second greatest loss of any foreign war in our history. World War II, 419,000 American troops killed. Vietnam, 58,700. World War I was about 50,000. Korea was about 35,000. So Vietnam was a huge loss. Now, I don't make light of the fact that there are about 3,400 Americans who have now died in Iraq. It's relatively small compared to Vietnam. Again, I don't make light of the loss of any life. In fact, I have a dear friend at Boston University who's a retired lieutenant, army colonel. His son, 27-year-old son, a lieutenant, was just killed in Iraq. And it's a terrible tragedy. I think that this sense that we're sort of trapped is a hangover from the Vietnam War. The reason I think the feeling of criticism, of dissent, of opposition has surged so strongly on Iraq is that it stands in the shadow of Vietnam. People remember Vietnam, and they are fearful that we're getting back into a similar trap. It's so destructive to a presidential administration when you get into a war costing the country blood and treasure, and that it seems to be out of control. The most astute president in this regard was Franklin Roosevelt. In the run-up to World War II, he understood that he could not manufacture a crisis that would suffice when America got into Second World War, that we could sustain the losses and sustain a consensus in the country. You can't fight one of these wars without an ongoing consensus. And Roosevelt, he didn't have anything to do with manipulating and creating Pearl Harbor, but for him it was a godsend in that it unified the country and gave him the capacity to really lead the country in a unified way. Johnson didn't have that with Vietnam. Bush doesn't have that now with Iraq. See, so I think there is a striking parallel. And the dilemma for the country now is, what are we going to do? How are we going to manage this? How are we going to bring this to a satisfactory conclusion? I don't know the answer to it. I don't know that anybody does. But it's a painful dilemma. Yes, sir?
Let me give you a setup, because I thought it was pure fiction 25 years ago when I saw a movie. As I recall, it starred Burt Lancaster as a disaffected American Army general from Vietnam, mm-hmm. who kidnapped a Minuteman missile silo in order to hold the American government hostage until they admitted that they had prolonged the war in Vietnam for no other purpose than to show the Soviet Union that we would spend 58,000 lives,
yes,
without using the nuclear bomb. And therefore, they could feel comfortable and not triggering the. Now it sounds like that might have a plausible basis for it.
No.
Well,
Nixon had something called the madman theory. The idea being that tell the Soviets, tell the Chinese, tell our adversaries, tell the North Vietnamese that Nixon really is a madman, and he will consider using a nuclear weapon against you. No, they weren't going to do it. Create this illusion, create the impression that this is a great danger to our adversaries. So Nixon was very shrewd about that, but of course, didn't work. Yes, sir.
So as a follow-up to that, what kind of president would Nixon have been if he was totally sane?
what kind of president would Nixon have been if he were totally sane? A really great president because, he was a very bright man, very bright man. And I mean, I must say, I'm so jaundiced about this stuff. Can anybody really be sane and want that job? I mean, who is it? James Garfield, the 19th century Republican president, who was there very briefly after a month, he said, what is there about this job that anybody would ever want to get into it? See, Jefferson called it a splendid misery. Herbert Hoover described it as a compound hell. Harry Truman said it was like riding on the back of a tiger. He called the White House the great big white prison. They all, I mean, it's a torturous job. Yes, sir.
One of the debates in history and politics is about whether history is driven by events or really driven by personalities. Do you have some views on that?
Sure. Well, I think it's both. I mean, I do think that men do make a difference. You know, think if Winston Churchill hadn't been there in World War II. Think of if Adolf Hitler had been assassinated in 1939. See, now, you know, maybe there would have been some other monster to take its place. But, I mean, people do make a difference. But on the other hand, circumstances make a difference too, a huge difference. As Napoleon once said, give me generals who know something about tactics and strategy, but best of all, give me generals who are lucky. See, or Lincoln said, I freely admit I have not controlled events. Events have controlled me. See, so, I mean, I think it's, and you have to look at it case by case, moment by moment, year by year, to see who maybe is perhaps dominating the development.
In that case, do you think in the case of Nixon and Kissinger, do you think more personalities drove these events and the successes as well as the failures?
Yeah, I do.
Or do you think they were pushed by events?
Well, I think both. It's a combination of the two, but these were two very powerful personalities and two men who really were so ambitious for influence, for power, to dominate. I interviewed Henry Kissinger for this book, and I asked him, I said, what do you think accounts for your celebrity? See, because I said, secretaries of state come and go. How many people remember Cordell Hull? Cordell Hull, the longest serving secretary of state in American history under Franklin Roosevelt. You ask my university students who are taking a course in presidential history, they don't have a clue. But Kissinger is remembered and will be remembered. And so he answered me by saying, what do you think accounts for my celebrity? Anyway, I told him that some journalists had recently told me they thought he was very adept at manipulating or controlling the press. And he got angry and he said, well, that's not the only reason. I said, no, no, of course not. It's Judge.
What is your explanation as to why the tapes were running? We know the 18-minute gap. Why
yes.
Would Nixon in particular allow himself to be recorded when he is crude and
yep.
racist
yes.
and anti-Semitic,
yes.
et cetera, et
yeah.
cetera?
Yeah. Well, sure. What accounts for the fact that Nixon would make such tapes in which he's cursing, he's so vulgar, he's so crude, he's so overbearing. He knows that the difference between the tapes that Kennedy and Johnson made were Johnson would signal the secretary if he wanted to tape a conversation, he'd go like this, see, tape it. But Nixon's tapes were all voice activated. So everything is going on. Now, during the Watergate crisis, we have that famous conversation in which he talks about bribes, and then you hear him leaning into the microphone saying, but it would be wrong. See? Sure, right. I mean, he's posturing for history. But the question is, and why does Kissinger leave behind these transcripts? I think, first of all, I don't think Nixon ever thought that all these tapes would see the light of day. I don't think he believed that they would ever come to hand as a consequence of Watergate. He didn't anticipate that. And he thought several times about destroying them. But once the information was out there as a result of the Sam Ervin's Watergate Committee hearings, it became almost impossible for him to do it. Kissinger, I think these men are so ego-driven. I think they want to leave behind things that will so engage historians' biographies that they'll be talking about them forever. I'll give you one example. Lyndon Johnson. Most curious tape conversation he ever made. I cannot understand why he taped it, because, as I said, he instructed that these be made. Conversation to him. Have any of you ever heard this? Conversation to him talking with the maker of Hagar slacks. Have you heard this? Calls this guy up. He says, "You the fellow makes them Hagar slacks?" And the guy says, "Yes, Mr. President, yes." He said, "Well, last summer you made me 5 pairs of pants." He ticks off the colors and he says, "I need you to make me 5 more pairs of pants." This summer ticks off the colors. And he says, "Now listen, man, you got to give me more room in the crotch, because them pants are cutting my nuts something awful." I mean, this is for posterity? I mean, you know. But, yeah. It's amazing, just amazing. But of course, we historians love it. I mean, and what are we going to have in the future? I'm hoping emails will replace this. Yes, sir.
Why did Nixon appoint Kissinger to be Secretary of State after he was National Security Advisor?
Yeah, because by then, Kissinger had established himself as so formidable a figure in this Nixon administration. This is September 73. Nixon also is, again, he's in the throes of Watergate, and what he wants to do is to use foreign policy to blunt the Watergate crisis. Some people have said that he had Spiro Agnew there as a firewall against his impeachment. And then he talked that appointing Gerald Ford could be something of a firewall, because the attitude was, well, people won't think Ford is presidential, you see. But he appoints Kissinger because he needs his celebrity, he needs his standing. And the plan is to use foreign policy to save Nixon from Watergate, and Kissinger collaborates with him on that. He is very much someone who tried to help Nixon survive Watergate. He talks to congressmen, talks to senators, about you can't throw them out, you can't drive them out. It's hurts national security. One last point I would make. I raise in the book the question about the 25th Amendment of the Constitution, which talks about the suspension of power of an incapacitated president. Now, what I raise in there is the question, Nixon at times was incapacitated, not by any means totally, but at times, as I showed you, he's drunk, he's asleep, maybe he was on sedatives, or maybe he was drunk again, I don't know. But I asked the question, why didn't Kissinger, who's Secretary of State, raise the question with the cabinet of invoking the 25th Amendment of the Constitution? Because he constantly talks about the fact that Nixon's weakened presidency is jeopardizing national security. See, if he really believed that, why doesn't he? Now, of course, what he knew was that Nixon would have described this as a political coup, and was not so incapacitated that he couldn't fight back, and that then he might have fired Kissinger. And Henry was very attentive to protecting his own power. And Gerald Ford said later that Kissinger was the most thin-skinned public official I ever dealt with in my public career. And when Ford forced him out of the National Security Advisor's office, and because he said Henry would come in every Monday morning and threaten to resign, he said he had to stroke him and deal with him in the most effective ways. He's very thin-skinned. I had an excerpt of my book in Vanity Fair, and Brent Scowcroft told somebody else, it told me that Henry was furious and livid. And I said he had every right to be livid against himself for having left those tapes behind. Thank you. I think we...
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.